You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So law enforcement, fire services, emergency medical services, first responders are on the front lines of the coronavirus outbreak. And across the country, there is an explosion of new cases every day, thousands being identified, which is expected to continue in the days ahead. We're looking at how rural emergency workers are preparing for this worsening pandemic. Are you a rural health provider? Do you feel ready? Do you work for a volunteer fire department? Have you responded to calls that were flagged as possible coronavirus cases? What precautions do you take? We're at 800-642-1234. Amanda Bates is Conference and Education Director for the Wisconsin EMS Association. She's been a paramedic firefighter in Wisconsin since 2014 and a firefighter since 2012. Amanda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So you have been responding to some calls that were flagged as possible coronavirus infections. What extra precautions are you taking when you go on these calls?
Sure. When the patient has been identified by dispatch as being a possible travel exposure or COVID patient, we have to don full isolation before we make contact with the patient or any members of their home. So we're gowning up, we're masking up, we're double masking up, we're gloving up, booties and safety goggles.
And so that looks pretty foreign, maybe, to some a paramedic, how we usually see a paramedic. What does it feel like to do those things?
It's definitely foreign for us. We're normally, ready to jump and go. We prepare before we even exit the ambulance. Now we have to stop and we have to don the PPE. We have to look each other over and then we can proceed. It's also foreign to the patients as well. We look kind of scary coming in. It almost looks like a biohazard scene, something out of a movie, especially with kids. You know, they don't get to see our faces. It's a little disturbing for them. And we just tell them that we have to do this for protection, theirs and ours.
Are you worried about exposure to yourself? Do you know if you have been exposed?
We know that in the county that I work for, there has been positive COVID cases, but we don't know if those came through our area, if we were the transporting agency for them. It is a concern and it is a worry. I have a family. I have a 13-year-old daughter. I have friends. I have, a life and people that I see too. And one of the worst things I think that could happen is an exposure. And I then expose my work family and my home family. That to me and my patients, that's a big concern.
Walk us through what you do after a shift. How do you disrobe? How does that work?
It's a new process. So immediately after my shift, I am one washing my hands before I even take a shower. I'm going to the shower. I'm bagging up my uniform. I use one towel. I shower. I bag that towel. I bag both those items together in one bag. I go home. It's in my trunk compartment in my vehicle. When I get home, I actually put on a different set of clothes. I wear those clothes home. When I get home, I take those items out of my trunk. I put them in my garage. I'm spraying down my car with Lysol, and then I am basically disrobing in my garage, and my husband's handing me another set of clothes before I make a run for it.
We are talking about first responders and their work right now amid the coronavirus pandemic. Amanda Bates is a paramedic firefighter. She's telling us about what her life looks like right now. How is your agency responding to the pandemic? What do you think people should know? How do you feel about the state's response to contain the virus? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Amanda, I think of all the PPE equipment that your team is putting on each day when you need to or when you feel like you may need to. Are you running short on supplies?
We are. There is a one point where we were 3 weeks from running out of supplies for a normal call volume. We were lucky enough to receive a shipment of PPE from DHS earlier last week, I believe. DHS is periodically doing a scarce resource decision tree where agencies can fill out basically an application to receive masks, gowns, gloves of all sizes. And then DHS makes the ultimate decision who gets what and where it goes.
So with the supplies that you asked for, did you get what you asked for?
I don't think that we received everything that we asked for, but I understand their rationing of, you know, equipment and why they have to do it that way. I know that there's going to be multiple rounds. So
yeah. When you get the calls from dispatch, is dispatch doing additional triage on 911 calls, meaning that are they asking more questions to get a better handle on whether you are going into a possible COVID-19 situation?
They are. For the PSAP centers in the state of Wisconsin who use EMD, Emergency Medical Dispatch software, they follow a pandemic protocol and they read those questions from that. Now, you have services, or you have PSAP centers in Wisconsin who are not EMD certified, and they should have their own in-house questions that they're asking. And I think best practices would be for that communicating agency, that PSAP center, to work with their police department and with their fire department so that they are asking the most appropriate question to make that determination.
And when you say PSAP center, what do you mean by that?
So PSAP centers are public service access points.
Okay.
They're the county communication centers or the centers that are the 911 centers that are run through like sheriff's departments.
What are some of those questions? What may be asked to someone calling 911?
Is anyone in your house sick or experiencing flu-like symptoms? Have you been running a fever? Have you been any travel outside of the United States, or even now it's outside of Wisconsin?
How is your?
Have you tested positive for COVID-19? They're coming out and asking too if they've been tested and if they have been tested positive, if they're being treated for it.
How is your team? How are fellow paramedics holding up in this?
I am blessed to work for just an amazing service. Our chief is outstanding, and he is taking every precaution to keep us safe, to keep our patients safe, and to keep our family safe. I have the utmost faith and respect in my department and my crew. So I think we're going to be okay. I'm very optimistic about this. Also working for the Wisconsin EMS Association, we are hearing all sorts of stories from our members on their PPE and their staffing. I'm cautiously optimistic for some of them. Some in rural Wisconsin, you have a lot of providers that are older, the 50s, 60s. They work for volunteer agencies. They might be hurt the most with staffing and lack of PPE, and those are the services that I worry about.
Yeah, because it's older staffers, it's volunteers, and mm-hmm. when personal protective equipment is in short supply, that too is a risk. We're looking mm-hmm. at EMS readiness in our rural communities in the face of the global pandemic. Amanda Bates is our guide. She is with the Wisconsin EMS Association. She's a paramedic firefighter. Do you work for a volunteer fire department that has responded to calls that were flagged as possible coronavirus cases? What precautions did you take? Are you a volunteer firefighter yourself? Do you have enough staff with you? Do you have enough supplies? What do you need? Join in 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment for more conversation with Amanda Bates right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about Wisconsin's first responders and how they're preparing for coronavirus calls. On the national level, EMS associations are urging Congress to help fund response efforts and provide access to PPE that we've been talking about, personal protective equipment and testing. And the groups want COVID-19 response reimbursement. They want tax deduction for EMS personnel. They want direct funding for ambulance and medical equipment. So are you a volunteer paramedic? What supplies do you have? And how are you coping with the pandemic? What things do you need? Do you have enough people to respond to a serious outbreak? Join in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We have Amanda Bates with us. She is a paramedic firefighter in Wisconsin, and she stays with us. Amanda, how important is it to practice social distancing for the safety of first responders who are entering an area?
Yeah, I think it's very important. I know it seems like a tall ask for people, you know, not to venture out and seek kind of the social groups that us as humans are wired for. Just stay at home. So we see those charts all the time. One person can infect five, then can infect 17, then can infect 200. That's a lot, especially when you're not showing signs or symptoms for 14 days. It can be scary. People can just be walking around with it, with a fever, a low-grade fever, or sneeze next to you. You touch something that their, you know, aerosolized particles have landed on, and now you're rubbing your eye or you're picking something out of your tooth, and you're exposed now. I mean, it's scary.
If people do have extra supplies on hand, extra masks or gowns right now, could they donate them to their local agencies?
Absolutely, and please do that. There's agencies who have already put out a call for help on social media platforms like Facebook. And the outpouring that their communities have provided have been just outstanding. I know one service in general received over like 15 cases of N95 masks and Painter coveralls for their crew, which, you know, they couldn't be more grateful for that. It's not the fact that they don't have the money to purchase them right now, which that may become an issue for some of these services. It's just that there is nothing to purchase. And we just can't have people being exposed.
Do you think it would be good to first contact your local hospital or first call your fire department? Well, where might you start?
Yeah, if definitely the hospital systems or your living care facilities. I know that they're a critical level. EMS services, any one of those, just give them a call and say, look, I got some of this stuff hanging around. It might be past expiration date. Or, you know, I'm looking, if you need it, I'm willing to drop it off, and you can do that. You can leave it outside the door. I know a lot of agencies aren't letting any public visitors in, but it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, leave a gift package at the door.
You have your pulse on the state, you know, with your role with the Wisconsin EMS Association. What concerns are you hearing from volunteer fire departments around the state?
It's staffing. So if there's two neighboring agencies, you have Service A and you have Service B, and if members of Service A get sick, they need cross-credentialing with Service B to help cover their staff. So right now you have agencies that are on borders, like on Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, who could use help, vice versa. I think at some point it might be a worthwhile conversation for having dual licensure in states and making it easier for providers to back up their neighboring agency. Just because it's across the street, it's still across state line, and they have a hard time staffing theirs just as we do in those rural areas.
Right, and certainly also if they have older volunteer firefighters, like you mentioned, in their 50s and 60s, that too is an age group that's at a higher risk for serious illness. Do you feel like rural areas could be more exposed because even though people are more far apart, there is also more difficulty to get to the hospitals and more difficulty to get access to a paramedic on, you know, for a 911 mm-hmm. call?
Yep. In rural communities, you see sicker patients. Also, it's just the hospital systems. They might not have an ICU bed, so then you have longer transport times of that patient to a critical hospital.
We're talking with Amanda Bates right now. She's the Conference and Education Director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. We're getting perspective on what her life looks like right now. Are you a volunteer firefighter or a volunteer firefighter paramedic? What are your calls like? How is your agency preparing? Do you have enough staff and supplies in your community? What are you looking for right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. In terms of credentialing, Amanda, are there specific credentials that have to be continuing education requirements that need to be addressed right now?
There are. So all EMS providers in the state of Wisconsin, they're licensed to practice in the state through DHS expires at the end of June. And I know that there was an ask for that expiration date to be extended to September 30th, just giving providers more time to seek out education. It's tough to find refresher courses right now for paramedics, AEMTs, and EMTs, and even EMRs in the state. And unfortunately, the go-to place has been the technical colleges, and we just can't have those classes right now. They offer phenomenal recertification courses, but we just can't get there. We can't congregate more than five. They can't host a class on site. So our access to getting the high-quality education that we want and that we seek out is not there right now.
Did you feel like your training prepared you for this moment?
My initial training was more patient-based. It wasn't pandemic-based. But my training with my department is outstanding. I'm very blessed to work with a progressive and an education-focused department where we train.
And keep doing those drills until they become almost second nature. So when you are called into that emergency, those skills kind of kick in?
Exactly. And too, right now with the donning and the doffing of PPE, those are skills that should be trained and refreshed on, just how to fit the N95 mask on your face. I mean, that's important too.
Do you feel like you have the bandwidth to be able to even take extra shifts right now in the face of, let's say, a really much more serious outbreak in your area?
If called, I will do that. Absolutely.
What are you needing at this moment right now?
I guess just for the public to follow the CDC guidelines and to do their best that they can to social isolate and to just be kind. I saw some videos of overcrowding in the ERs, you know, then your nurses are getting stressed out, and that trickles to the doctors, and that trickles, you know, back to the patients and to the EMS providers who are bringing in more patients to an already overflowed and overloaded system. So just be kind and have some patience. And I think this is an opportunity for people to come together, believe it or not, and find ways to work together, get through this together, because that's what it's going to take.
Do you have to move your shifts around? Are you able to see your family on a regular basis when they can expect you at home?
I am. I'm very blessed right now. The Wisconsin EMS Association, we have a exceptional leader at our organization as well. All of our staff members are working from home. So I do get to spend some time with my daughter, who is trying to be the typical teenager. And which is tough right now. That's another conversation. And then with the fire department, I'm scheduled for shifts throughout the month. And I'm also available to pick out shifts as needed if someone was to get sick or if they're being called in at their other department. Absolutely. We're a little family and we try to take care of ourselves.
How does this look like on the firefighting side? I mean, if there is a blaze and a building is on fire, how are you managing staying safe and all of the equipment, and also, you know, looking at how do you fight this fire?
So we do wear SCBAs, so you're protected. So you're on air when you're anywhere near a fire, whether that be a car fire, especially a garage fire or a house fire, even a garbage fire. So you have a respirator on your face, basically blocking those particles if there was to be something biohazardly burning. We do the same thing that we do every time. So I feel pretty confident on that side. It's just some unknowns, I guess, with the virus and the pathogen side that make you pause and make you sometimes second guess yourself. But I mean, I feel pretty good.
Well, Amanda, we're thinking of you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Amanda Bates, she is a paramedic firefighter and education director for the Wisconsin EMS Association. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll be joined by the head of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. Are you a physician or a nurse in a rural community? What are you seeing, and how is your clinic or your hospital preparing for COVID-19 illnesses? Do you have enough beds? Are you thinking about converting some break rooms for additional beds? Where are you at with your planning? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll talk more right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Two programming things I want to point out to you on COVID-19. We've added more state news updates throughout the day each weekday, and you can hear them after NPR newscasts at the top of each hour. And then do check out our website for the live coverage of the daily White House Coronavirus Task Force briefings. Go to WPR.org for those real-time updates. Right now, we're looking at rural healthcare and the coronavirus stimulus package. Healthcare providers may be able to tap into $100 billion meant to prop up their finances during the pandemic. But some rural hospitals fear they won't get a fair share of the money that's part of the $2 trillion economic stimulus and relief bill. So are you a physician or a nurse in a rural area? Are you a patient worried about the pandemic? Do you have a plan for how to respond if cases are diagnosed in your rural community? We're at 800-642-1234. John Ike is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for inviting me.
So on our Wisconsin rural landscape, there have been some cases of COVID-19 reported in rural areas like Green and Wood counties. How have these outbreaks been managed by the healthcare systems there?
I think they've been managed quite well. The rural healthcare system is strong and very competent, so they can handle whatever comes their way, including this. The challenge is what we're all looking at is what if it gets a lot worse? And certainly what we're being told is that it could get a lot worse. So the question there is, do we have enough beds for care? Do we have enough rural EMS personnel to transport people? What if some of us get sick? How do we handle those? How do we handle those surges?
And it could get a lot worse, even for rural areas.
Yeah, it obviously can. I mean, it's the strange thing about this virus is it travels person to person, community to community. So even in a rural area that is distant from an urban center, there's still the chance that one person comes into that community, meets with someone in a nursing home, and then that nursing home goes around there like wildfire. But that can be one community that has an outbreak, and then 20 miles down the road at the next one, they don't have that outbreak. So it's a weird, uneven thing. And I would say that unevenness is really part of the challenge. When we did a poll recently among rural hospital and EMS folks around the state, and what I heard back from them is there's this disconnect that we're all feeling. Whether you're in a city or a rural area, there's this sense of what you hear on the news about the terrible impacts. But when you actually look around you, most of us don't know someone who's been tested positive. that disconnect is even greater out in a rural area. That means that all of those disruptions, the childcare disruptions, schools, jobs, have happened immediately. But the virus feels even further away. And that brings both a lot of worry and uncertainty. But also, I think, again, this sense of disconnect from what's going on in other areas, it's more pronounced in rural areas.
And that might make be inclined for health systems in rural areas, perhaps, or even people living in rural areas to say, why? Why should we be preparing like this? We don't see it around us yet. What is going to hit us?
Yeah. And unfortunately, the lack of consistent messaging is a challenge. If our whole country could be united in one direction or another, I think it would be a lot easier on folks because they'd feel like we're all part of the same challenge. But unfortunately, what has happened at the national level, and even the state level, you know, at this larger than community level, is this sense of people disagreeing, telling us different things, you know, on one day saying it's going to be this and another saying it's going to be that. The federal approach being different than the state approach. It's understandable. We're all figuring this out as we go along. But what that does to a person in a community who's trying to do the best for their staff, for their patients, and for the community at large is really challenging.
So as you are in contact with hospitals and clinics in rural parts of the state, you're surveying them, seeing what they are needing as they start to figure out how to prepare for this. What are they telling you?
They're saying that it's a lot of the same challenges that the cities are going through. The personal protective equipment is in low supply like it is everywhere. We have some, but not necessarily enough for what we think could be coming. It's almost like those tsunamis that we hear about in other parts of the world where everything gets quiet all of a sudden and you can and the water drains away, but you can just feel that something's coming. So it's that same thing. We don't have enough protective equipment, whether that's in a hospital for providers or for EMS, for the first responders. The testing is minimal. The tests available are minimal, and the testing results are slow to come back because we need to have courier services to a lab that's actually testing. So that's a challenge. The disruption that's happened from the smaller hospitals have stopped their elective procedures and surgeries, which impacts their bottom line drastically. The staff are sort of on standby. Again, in most communities, we're not seeing the level of cases. We're sure that it's possible and even likely, but it's this weird limbo state that's a real challenge for folks.
So let's look at the financials for a moment as we see the cancellation of routine clinical visits and perhaps some routine type of surgeries, or not routine, but things that aren't a pressing need. How does that hurt a hospital or a clinic's bottom line?
Well, it's as well as serving the health needs of their patients, it is also their business. And so much like the businesses that have been shuttered across communities, the hospitals too have felt the same thing. Every time they do a procedure or every time they work with a patient, that is revenue for them. So for them to stop all but the most critical procedures means that their revenue has been drastically hit, which is a challenge for them trying to make sure that they are paying their staff, that they are buying, they have the revenue to buy the materials that they need or the supplies they need, et cetera. It's a significant hit.
We're talking with John Eich, who is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, looking at how rural communities are preparing for COVID-19. Are you a healthcare provider in a rural part of the state? Do you feel prepared for the coronavirus pandemic? What are you telling your teams, your staff? Are you a hospital administrator? How is this affecting your bottom line? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John, Wisconsin officials said this week that supplies from the Strategic National Stockpile were sent to providers around the state. Do you know if rural facilities got items from these shipments?
They did. The challenge is always, if you can imagine, there's a line to have things handed out. And I think rural both experiences and also worries that they are at the end of that line. These are desperate times for people. The staff in the hospitals and clinics are worried not just about the being within the facility, but also being out in the community. So this personal protective equipment is like gold, because it's the health and wellness for everyone around you. And so while the supplies are coming and people are donating, and they do have some to begin with, the lack of it is really challenging and makes it much more difficult as we think about this virus increasing. If we can't protect our staff as they're providing patient care, they're going to get sick. And when they get sick, they're going to be less able to help the patients. So it's a great worry.
Are there plans in place for a health crisis like this? Do communities think about these and put these together? What is the plan in rural areas for a big catastrophe?
So ever since 9/11, there's been a strong push for preparedness. There are coalitions that meet on a state level. They meet regionally. Every hospital and EMS service and clinic have plans in place. But that being said, what we thought we were preparing for, whether that's a tornado or natural event, or whether it's a mass shooter or even terrorism, was what we had experienced before. We can only, in a sense, kind of get ready for what we know. And what we're being caught by surprise with here is the pandemic. I think in the future, we'll be much better at planning for this. I think there's a lot of lessons and messages from this that we're going to absorb and get better at. But for right now, it's sort of looking to the north for the disaster and suddenly being hit from the side. So we certainly are prepared for this. Folks are trained. They're professionals. They're doing great work. But the question is, are we fully prepared? And the answer is no.
Communication lines are open as well. Do you see rural clinics and hospitals talking to each other?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of networking between facilities. There is in our state a cooperative of 43 hospitals and that meets regularly. EMS talks amongst themselves. They come together at the county level, working on issues. There's emergency services coordinators at every county that are bringing the services together. So yeah, they are. And I would say that one of the things rural does best is come together as a community.
We're talking with John Eich, the director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, which works to improve access to and the quality of rural health care. Are you a health care provider in a rural part of the state? What are your conference calls like right now? Do you have a plan for how to respond if and when coronavirus cases are diagnosed in your community? How are you going to scale up the response? Join in, be part of this, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with John Eich in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Congress is considering $100 billion in emergency funding to hospitals bracing for the coronavirus under a massive stimulus package. But some cash-strapped rural and safety net hospitals have already warned, as we've been talking about, their ability to make payroll after canceling non-emergency elective procedures. So we're looking at preparedness in Wisconsin's rural areas with the Office of Rural Health. If you're a rural physician or a hospital or a clinic administrator, how ready are you? How stable are your facility's finances? Are you working on plans to share resources with neighboring hospitals? How far away are they? Are they across one of our borders? How does that look like to work together? Join in with your situation, your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The Office of Rural Health Director John Ike stays with us. So, John, you've used words like rural communities are nimble and they can innovate. What advantages might rural areas have in fighting this pandemic?
Well, I think the communication works really well at a community level. I think people are naturally more inclined to trust each other. They're more inclined to work together. As you quoted, just the fact that there's fewer structures around, people are able to try something out, to experiment with something, to innovate. There's a lot of power in what they can bring to this equation.
Oh, so there might be less red tape to be able to get something done at a very local level. If their neighbor says, "Hey, I need this. How can you do it? How can you restructure?"
Yeah, absolutely. It's the difference between turning the Titanic and turning your car. If you have a smaller hospital or EMS service with fewer people, and you say, "Hey, gang, let's do this instead," people can get on board and make that change quickly. Versus if you've got a very large organization, that's a slow turn.
You mentioned testing earlier. Is it more difficult for people living in a rural area to get tested for the coronavirus?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult for us all to get tested. There just aren't enough tests. And the production, bringing them up online has been very slow. But the difference is going to be distance to a testing facility. If you happen to live in a city that has a testing facility, then someone just needs to drive that test across town. If you live an hour away from that city, that testing site, well, you see where I'm going with that. So, and not only that, but it can't just be anybody that couriers that, that takes that test to the lab. You have to get a dedicated courier service, and they're stretched now suddenly having to take these things to every community across the state.
So how much capacity do you see in rural hospitals if they do have to increase their admissions? Are there literally enough beds? Is there enough room?
No. I mean, it really depends on, we're all looking at projections. We're looking at what's happened in other countries. We're trying to apply that here. It's been clearly identified that in every context, in a New York City and in a Madison and in Amory, Wisconsin, there are enough beds for what we normally see. There are not enough beds for a true pandemic. And so that's going to be a challenge. And again, it's that doubling effect as well. When the people, the healthcare providers and staff that are dealing with patients that are COVID positive and they get sick, then they're less able to handle the influx. And the other question is, what happens if there's a second surge or a third surge? When we look back to things like the 1918 flu epidemic, the second and third surges were actually more deadly than the first. And my fear is that what we're going to see in rural areas will tend to be at a pace where it might be the second surge. And it's hard for people to say, "Wait, there's an emergency. Everybody shut everything down." But hold on, hold on, wait, hold on more. And at a certain point, people are going to let down their guard. And maybe we'll see the kind of cases in urban areas where it will feel like it came in time, that people will still want to crouch in readiness. But I think in rural areas, it's going to be a lot easier as they're waiting and waiting to go back to business as usual. And that's when the second surge could possibly hit them.
When they let their guard down.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking with John Ike, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. Still time for you to join in this conversation about what rural communities are facing with the pandemic and how your rural community is responding. How are your neighbors looking out for each other? How is your local clinic communicating information to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. email ideas@wpr.org. So, John, the National Rural Health Association says 20% of the U.S. population does live in rural areas, but only 11% of physicians practice there. What is the situation like in terms of the number of doctors and, medical professionals who can staff up and respond?
So when they look at when they do the calculations to determine an underserved area, in other words, where there aren't enough providers for the population, most of those underserved areas are in rural parts of the state. So certainly it depends community to community. So there are large areas of the state where they already in normal times do not have enough physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, et cetera, to meet the needs. People do well, and they meet the needs as best as they can. But if the system is already strained, and then you add in something like this, it could be a recipe for some very difficult times.
And oftentimes that rural doc is one of the lifelines to the community, the heartbeat of the community, a public face in that community and helping it come together.
Yeah, absolutely. People know each other in rural, and so they certainly know who their doctors and providers are.
What is the Office of Rural Health working on right now and today and then in the next few days? What are you doing?
So our job now is to strike a delicate balance. I mean, everybody is throwing information out at every person in healthcare. It's kind of like an avalanche of information. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that things aren't being missed for our constituent hospitals, providers, EMS, et cetera, that we're looking for the rural angle. We're looking for examples in other states to see what they're doing. We're finding out what resources might be particularly relevant. We're trying to reach out and listen to what folks in rural areas are saying versus a lot of the conversation is happening in cities so that we can help advocate for the rural experience at the policy level.
At the policy level, do you think in recent years, you've been doing this a while, are we hearing the call to action for rural areas for healthcare? Is it becoming stronger?
Well, I think with the 2016 election, rural became a very important factor. And since then, we've certainly seen on all levels of government, certainly the federal level is much more interested in hearing what rural has to say. But also, as the country experienced that election and went, hold on, at the state level, at the county level, I do think that there is more interest in what rural has to say. When you're handing out resources, which is part of the work that happens at all levels, it still feels like rural is at the end of that line. But we're very good at making do with a little bit and stretching things to work. So,
John, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for asking the question.
John Ike is director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. Earlier, we heard from Amanda Bates, a paramedic firefighter. We've been examining how rural communities are preparing for the coronavirus pandemic. Coming up, it's a look at how to keep children engaged with reading as schools are closed and families are urged to stay home. And then later on the program, we learn how the pandemic is affecting small businesses and low-income families and how lawmakers are responding. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this is the Ideas Network.